We're continuing. We just read Arami Oved Avi, and now we're going to see the breakdown each one. So we know how the Aramean wanted to destroy us. We just explained that. Ve'erod Mitzrayma. And then Yaakov went down to Egypt. Anusa Piyadibur. God forced him to go. He didn't want to go. He knew that when he goes down, this was the beginning of a terrible period in Jewish history. Hashem said it. He did it. But he only did it because Hashem said it. And this is a word of rebuke to all those people that are in Shmutzart and they don't have to be. Yaakov Avinu, his son, was viceroy of Egypt. But he wouldn't go down to Egypt until Hashem said, go. And then he had to. Vayagol Sham, when he went there, he was a sojourner. Yaakov thinks he's going down for 400 years. But there's an attitude. Do I go to Brooklyn and build myself a mansion and say, I'm here? Or do I say, I'm leaving? What do I have to build a big house for? So Yaakov goes down to Egypt, and his perspective, and the perspective he wants to give over to his children is, we're leaving. I know a family that lived in Chutzlarts. They emigrated from Israel to Chutzlarts. And every year when they make the second day holiday, the second day Yom Tov, the mother would wake up in the morning of the second day Yom Tov and not set the table. And the kids would come home from shul and say, Ima, aren't we having a Yom Tov meal? And she'd say, oh, right, we're in Chutzlarts. We have to have a Yom Tov meal. I'm sorry, I forgot. And then she'd make this whole show on purpose so that the kids got this perspective. This isn't normal. We're in Chutzlarts.
Why did they move to Chutzlarts?
That's a good question. She didn't agree. Her husband said they had to go, and she didn't want to break up the family. She didn't agree. So every second Yom Tov, and then she'd serve them like leftovers or something. So technically, you're supposed to honor the second day Yom Tov. But she wanted the children to understand this is not normal. We don't belong here. So Yaakov Avinu goes down to Egypt, and he comes with the attitude, I will not sink in Egypt. I have to be here. I'll be here as a sojourner. So I don't have to take on the name Jack or Jill or all kinds of non-Jewish names. For sure, I'm not going to call my son Christopher, right? I don't have to change my language. You know, people always laugh at the Hasidim. The Hasidim only know how to say sir. So they turn to a woman and say, sir, right? but maybe they got the right idea. Maybe you don't have to master the language because maybe you're not supposed to be so comfortable there. Maybe you're not supposed to be there. So Yaakov comes with the attitude, I'm passing by here. When I left Israel, I had a problem. I didn't know when I'd be able to come back. So I was in Shmutzlarts, and I never changed my watch. It always stayed on Israeli time. How many times did people stop me and say, sir, your watch stopped? And I'd say, no, it didn't. And they'd say, and what time is it? And I'd say, it's on Israeli time. And they'd say, really, why? I'd say, because I'm on my way back. My chavrusa would say, really, when are you leaving? And I'd say, I don't know, when are you?
How long were you there?
About a year and a half. So people would be like, really, when are you leaving? And I'd say, I don't know, but when are you leaving? You don't belong here any more than I do. We don't belong here. I don't know when I'm leaving yet, but I know I don't belong here. Yaakov Avinu went with the attitude, I'm visiting.
What did you do then?
I was learning. I was in Shiva. That's what they tell Pharaoh. We came as sojourners. There's no more grazing for your servants' cattle. We your servants, the brothers tell Pharaoh, we have no more to feed our sheep. There's a terrible famine in Canaan, and you guys have the Nile. So let us live in the land of Goshen. So the Jews come there, and their attitude is, I don't have a choice, I need to. Okay, so I'm here, but I'm on my way out. They thought they were going to be there 400 years, but it's an attitude. What message do I give? What name do I call my kids? Do I tell them you have to blend in? You have to be like the neighbor? I know a guy who lived in Brooklyn before Brooklyn was all frumi. And he told me that when his son grew up, so his next door neighbor had a Christmas tree. And his next door neighbor had a boy and a girl, the ages of his children. And he told his son, look at where our lawn ends. You see where our lawn ends and his lawn begins? Well, the block does not exist in your mind beyond our lawn. I will never see you on the block beyond our lawn. Is that clear? If you have to get to a neighbor's house two houses down, you go the other way down the block. You make a circle all the way around, you come back. But you're never going in front of his house. Never. He wanted to ensure that his son doesn't marry the non-Jewish girl and the neighbor's non-Jewish girl. It worked.
What?
It worked. It worked. So, sounds a little extreme, but what's my attitude? If I think I'm here...
Yeah, married the Indian across the street.
You guys are laughing. I was just in Schmutzlertz this past Shabbos. It blew my mind. It blew my mind. People live there, and they're so friendly, and they're intercultural. What do you have to be intercultural for? Be proud of what you're doing.
Chicago.
Yeah.
Obama City.
It's right. I'm saying when Yaakov comes to Egypt, the attitude is I'm on my way back to Israel. There's no reason I should become best friends with all the non-Jews here. I have to keep my nucleus intact. It's hard enough. You see that it didn't work. You see that 4/5 of the Jews were not up to par. It's very hard work bringing up children in Chutz Lartz. Very hard. The temptations, what?
Should be friendly?
Well, there's friendly and there's, realize the temptation. Realize how dangerous it is. A guy goes to university in the United States, what are the odds he's going to marry Jewish? You know that if a person here in Israel is quasi-religious, what they call dati light, the odds of his great-grandchildren all marrying Jewish are approximately 70%. If a person is completely from in the United States, the odds of his great-grandchildren all marrying Jewish are about 25%. Think about it. Your children are friendly with the neighbors and the guy they go to college with, and then your grandchildren. What are the odds that three generations down, your great-grandson is not going to marry the agent who he's been doing lab with? She's a nice girl, Dad. She's very gentle. She's all the midot you brought us up with. You always told us to aspire and admire and see people who have good traits. I was nice to her. I was pleasant to her. One thing led to another. What do you want? I don't understand. It's far-fetched. Let me tell you something. I don't trust myself. I'm not talking about my grandchildren and great-grandchildren. I'm talking about me, Nathaniel Frankenthal. The temptation when you're exposed to people who are fine, kind people. So why shouldn't a person be attracted? We're all human. So you
teach them that Jews copy something that non-Jews can't.
Yeah, you really think that will stand in the way of temptation? I don't think so.
Jews are important to you, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I went home for a month. I don't have a single Jewish friend at home. What are you doing? Hang on my mom every day for a month?
It's a good question. But you have to understand that it's a question.
Yeah.
So Yaakov Avinu tries. He doesn't teach him Egyptian. They stay talking Hebrew. So they have a funny accent, but it helps them keep intact. They dress different. So people look at them and say, what are they doing? You know, I had a very interesting thing. Okay, this is a worthwhile tangent. You took me off on a tangent. On the Seder, you don't go off on tangents. But this is, you know, you guys are, many of you are going out to Schmutzlart soon, so you have to know this. I would tell you the long story, but because it's our model Seder, I'll keep it short. I was told the following story by a Chabadnik last week. These guys, every year this group of Chabad would light candles in a different mall. And they would look in a phone book, and they'd look at a mall, and then they'd call the managers of the mall, and they'd get permission where they could light in a public place, and they'd go to that mall. But they didn't go and see the mall beforehand. So one year, they signed up, they made arrangement with a certain mall, they came to that mall, they prepared the lighting, and then they discovered that the mall is closing down. There's one cinema left that's running and one restaurant, and the rest of the mall is already shut down. But it's too late to change plans, so they light in that mall. And they light, and they sing, and they give their speeches, and they have a small crowd, and they do what they do. Okay, end of that story. Next story. We're in Chabad, the shul, here in Jerusalem. And a man walks in the Chabad shul in Jerusalem, it's called the Tzemach Tzedek shul. So many people, Chabad, who are visiting in Israel, go to that shul. And they at the end of davening, each person tells their story, anyone who has a story. So a person gets up and tells the following story. He says he was working in that same city. At the other end of town, he was working with actors. And the actors were preparing their the play they were supposed to show in the theater. And they were all Jews who were not too observant. And next door to their rehearsal place was a Chabad house. And the Chabad house offered free coffee and free cake. So when their boss didn't show on time, they snuck out and they went and they had some coffee and cake in the Chabad house. So they're in the Chabad house and the boss shows up one day and no one's there. And he waltzes over to the Chabad house and they all turn red because they hear they were caught red-handed in the Chabad house. And the boss says, "Don't worry." They say, "Why?" He says, "Let me tell you a story about Chabad." He says, "A number of years ago, I was in the process of getting divorced. And my business was collapsing. And it seemed like all of life was falling apart all around me. And I didn't see that it would ever get better. I couldn't see a future in what I was doing. And I felt like there would never be a future in life. And so I was so down on myself that I decided I'm committing suicide. And I felt so bad, I said to myself, before I do it, let me at least leave my children with good memories. So I told my children the night beforehand, I said, let's go out for dinner. I took them downtown to that mall that's closing down. And I took them there for dinner and for a movie. When we get there, there are these Chabad fellows lighting this menorah and giving speech and singing and dancing and talking about light and life and how you never give up hope and you always continue giving off light. And as I'm dancing with my kids, I'm thinking, they have a point. And I changed my mind. So he said, I have no problem with you guys going into Chabad for coffee and cake because thanks to Chabad, I'm still here. And this person tells the story in the Chabad house. A guy gets up and says, really? Was that the mall? And he tells him the name of the mall. So the guy says, yeah. He says, was that this and this year? So he says, yeah. He says, I was one of the people there who set up. Until today, we always talk about what dunces we were to set up a menorah in a place where that was closing down and not look into it before. We thought that was our failure. That was the year that we failed as shlichim. And now we understand we didn't fail. So this Chabadnik told me the story. He said, this is an important story that we tell over in Chabad because we can never appreciate the value of how we affect people. You walk around in the street dressed as a frum Jew, you don't know how many people you're arousing to be observant. You don't know what your actions are affecting other people. You don't know. So he told me this story just before I went to fly last week. And I landed in Newark, and the flight was delayed, and I had to continue to Chicago, and I realized that because the flight was delayed, I wasn't going to make it in time to make it to a minyan. So ordinarily, I'd be embarrassed to put on talis and tefillin alone. No one was Jewish around me at that hour at the airport. I couldn't see another Jew for a mile. But what this Chabadnik told me gave me such a different thought about it. He said to me, you don't know how many people around you. When you walk around like a frum Jew, how many people you're inspiring. When you're doing what's right, you don't know the impact. So I went to my little corner. I didn't sit in the middle of the terminal, you know, where everyone's walking around. I still went to my corner, but I wasn't as embarrassed. I put the talus over my head. I put on my tefillin. I sat in my corner and I davened. And then I went on. But my point is, you say, what am I going to do out in wherever you're going to be for a month. You have to remember that when you do what's right, you don't know how many people you're impacting, how many waves you're making around you. And that's an important rule in life. That's what has to give us koach to move forward and do what's right. Maybe there's a better solution. So for that, we'll talk one-on-one.